welcome to this edition of The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined in the studio today by Madison, Connecticut Public School Superintendent Thomas Scarese. Thomas Scarese has been one of the more vocal superintendents in Connecticut when it comes to questioning what's being done to public education. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about your educational career and background?
Sure. I've been in the field for about 18 years now. I began out in related services in the special education area about 18 years ago. Served as an assistant principal, as a middle school principal in the Hartford region at a CREC area magnet school. I served as an assistant superintendent and have been in Madison now for almost 3 years.
Okay, so it sounds like you have a broad and extensive background in public education. And you're one of the few superintendents that I'm aware of who has spoken out about what's happening in education, this assault on public education. Maybe you can tell us a bit about your concerns and why you're one of the few speaking out.
There's a number of areas that I've raised questions about, and I think I should just begin by saying that what I seek to do is just raise critical questions about what I see as very important issues right now in education. I see a conversation needing to be had around a number of topics, and very important topics, because we're talking about preparing our kids for a very uncertain world. The 21st century has presented some incredible challenges with globalization, with rapid technology advances, and the world of work and the world of citizenship have changed so much. And how schools respond to that is going to be so important. And the responses have concerned me. The practices and policies of the past 10, 12 years, I believe, have taken us down the wrong path. Public schools have responded to societal challenges for decades, literally. Brown versus Board, desegregation efforts in the 70s, even go back to probably the seeds of the latest reforms, which would be back in 1983, A Nation at Risk. So that's not new. But what is new are the nature of the challenges, not the degree of the challenges. We've always had challenges to respond to, whether they were cultural or educational, intellectual, but the nature of the challenges and the way the world has changed, there is a need for a reinvention, if you will, of public schools. What that looks like, I think that dialogue should be robust and ongoing and not a case closed like we've lived the last, say, 10, 12 years in what's really a test-based accountability era.
Yeah. Now, we have with Race to the Top, districts were able to apply for that money, or the state was, and the state of Connecticut didn't get any of that money.
No.
And then we have the teacher evaluation tied to Race to the Top with the test scores and everything. How is that impacting your teachers?
Well, Race to the Top, if you look at it, if you applied and you got it, you had to follow those kind of high-level prescriptions around how teachers are evaluated, on how data systems are used, accumulated student data, on adopting college and career standards, which has become, in most states, the Common Core, and around access to charter schools and so forth. So all those conditions of Race to the Top. If you were a state that was able to secure the Race to the Top grant, and these are competitive grants in education, which on this scale is very unique. Federal grants have been more need-based historically. So that's a new approach. So a competitive grant. So you secure the money and you have those types of things you must put into policy and in legislation. If you didn't secure a grant, you had the opportunity to apply for a waiver from No Child Left Behind to be held harmless from those consequences of No Child Left Behind, those unrealistic expectations, which, interestingly enough, this year, 100% of our kids should be proficient in every area on standardized tests. So waivers were pursued by the remaining states, essentially, but you still were held to the same standards as the Race to the Top conditions. Mm-hmm. Charter school access, high-stakes test scores involved in teacher evaluation, college and career standards vis-a-vis the Common Core. So states were doing one or the other. They were either going to get the grant money through Race to the Top or pursue a waiver, but they were doing the same prescriptions as a result. And it has impacted schools in Connecticut. There's no question. I raised this in a letter to my state legislators, my state rep and my state senator back in January before the legislative session really got underway. I wrote a letter to them with concerns about the direction of the reform movement in Connecticut. And particularly, one of the things I pointed out was that, if anything, we should be pursuing any kind of latitude in our No Child Left Behind waiver. Did we overshoot the mark? And did we need to go as deeply as we did into the waiver? And I could be off base on that, by the way, but I think it's worth exploring. Mm-hmm. And like most things that I've tried to, I was hoping to start was a dialogue, mm-hmm. was just to ask questions and let's pursue that as opposed to a fait accompli.
Right.
So that Race to the Top and the No Child Left Behind waiver has reached classrooms. It's reached classrooms in implementation of Common Core, which is a whole separate topic to discuss. It's reached classrooms in the way teachers are evaluated, and that's pretty clear. When you identify what you're being evaluated on, that's going to impact your professional practice, you know, without question. So those areas have reached the classrooms in a matter of a couple of years. So federal legislation has reached down all the way into local classrooms.
And if a district didn't get the Race to the Top grant money and they didn't pursue the waiver, then this was the year that we had to have 100% of our kids at mastery,
yes,
on the test. And mm-hmm. what would happen if they didn't reach mastery?
Well, it goes by state. Mm-hmm. So your districts are all coupled together with other districts and the state applies for Race to the Top or for the waiver. And if you did not do either one, you would be held to the consequences of No Child Left Behind, which Washington State is in an interesting position right now because Washington State had their No Child Left Behind waiver revoked very recently. So right now they're faced with, I don't know what percentage, but a high majority of their school districts being labeled as failing districts. Well, one of the consequences is that you must offer students choice to attend schools that are not failing. And the state superintendent there, or the commissioner, I'm not sure what his title is, now is faced with a situation of, if almost all my districts are considered failures per the No Child Left Behind standard, where am I sending my kids? Where are these districts I'm finding? Because under the No Child Left Behind standard, they're all failing, nearly
all
of them.
Where are they going to go? Right.
Yeah. The more punitive, well, that's a punitive measure, obviously, but even the more painful one financially is districts must offer tutoring services and additional academic supports per No Child Left Behind. So if that does happen in Washington, you have a significant funding issue as well. So states were highly, highly incentivized to pursue either the waiver or the grant money, right, which was very lucrative for states who did that. Though there is a lot of buyer's remorse for those folks, those districts. I've read a lot online, Education Week and so forth. I talked to my colleagues over the border in New York. You know, a lot of buyer's remorse with the Race to the Top grant money that came, what it actually covered, and the position that they're in right now with the programs they must deliver as a part of that grant money.
So Washington State, I know, was the teachers' unions there kind of revolted on some of the testing. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like they're being punished now for their resistance or?
I don't know. From what I've read, and I'm no expert on this by any stretch, but from what I've read, it was Washington State's legislature's reluctance to include the specific state test in individual teacher evaluations. So what they, my understanding, is what they left open was a choice at the district level that you may choose. You must have student data, which, by the way, I agree with having student data appropriately in an evaluation of a teacher or a principal or a superintendent for that matter, appropriately done. But Washington State, my understanding was the legislature said you can use the state test, a district test, or a local school test or a series of. That wasn't good enough. And the Secretary of Education said, no, it must be the state test. So what that's opened up is an interesting situation that there are certain conditions for the waiver, but obviously certain ones weigh more heavily than others. Yet I don't believe that's been out in the open and discussed. Some states have certain areas focused and other areas not focused in their waivers. I don't know if it's been that explicitly stated that the state test must be in the evaluation of teachers to get a waiver, or if it's been broader, my understanding, the language much broader, that student data, student learning data would be in evaluation. So it's kind of messy right now out in the world of education.
Yeah. And if a state didn't go for Race to the Top or the waiver, and they're still operating under No Child Left Behind. Yeah. I don't know if there's any states doing that right now other than Washington.
Washington, but right now, is my understanding,
but isn't it under No Child Left Behind, the same idea where the state then can come in and fire teachers and create charter schools and that? So either way, you're going to get the same setup. So
all roads lead to a similar location, it sounds like.
Yeah. So they haven't left any really options for people to have some flexibility in this.
No, and I think if you look at the way the federal policy has unfolded over the last decade to 12 years, it's leading, and now with Race to the Top, it's leading to the same destination.
Yeah. So you had mentioned earlier, and we were talking about the definition of quality education and the narrowing of educational goals. Yeah. Maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I've talked about this a lot with colleagues and within my district. What I've seen happen in the last 10, 12 years is what I call a redefinition of what a quality education is. And that's incredibly concerning to me that we're narrowing the definition of quality education with every iteration of policy and law. It's now being reduced to a score. So whenever you hear the conversation about results, that's code for test scores. It's very clear. And I believe strongly that tests, by the way, educators created tests. We've invented that. Mm-hmm. So we value it. Right. We want tests. Mm-hmm. We want tests used for the purposes for which they were created. So if you go to a doctor and they give you a test on your blood pressure and then determine that you must have medications in all other different kinds of ailments, well, that's a misuse of the test. You want to be clear in education that when you have a test, tests are always created with a purpose in mind. And any psychometrician will tell you that. Once you start to misuse it, you've invalidated the test. And there's a concept that is fortunately being discussed more called instructional sensitivity. So you can give a test to a kid, a group of kids, a district, a state, but there's degrees to which that test is sensitive to individual teacher instruction because it may be more sensitive to other factors like background knowledge that a kid brings into a classroom from mm-hmm. family background. So when you have a test that's not instructionally sensitive and then use it to evaluate a teacher, you've set a teacher up for failure on one side or for just a gift on the other, that if the kids score well and it was nothing the teacher did, the teacher would benefit from mm-hmm. that. But the instructional sensitivity piece is key in that if we're going to use assessments in the evaluation of teachers, we must use assessments that are instructionally sensitive. So my concern with the definition of education being reduced to a test score is we're dismissing so many areas of life that need to be addressed in school when it comes to creating students or developing and fostering a diverse set of talents and abilities. They're walking out into a world. Our kids are going to leave our schools and go into a world that really honors innovation, critical thinking, that honors a diverse set of talents. That's what the whole concept of crowdsourcing is about in our era right now. You know, Wikipedia was not part of, at least my understanding, was not part of a strategic plan. That there was a boardroom and a bunch of leaders that got together, three or four people that said, here, we're going to create this and we're going to do it. It has developed and grown over time through crowdsourcing. Great experience on Twitter, actually, two nights ago. Yung Zhao, someone I read a great deal of, is a tremendous scholar and thinker. He wanted examples of student-based products in, I think, the middle school environment. He sends out a tweet. Within 24 hours, he has tons of examples and tons of ideas on that. That's that crowdsourcing concept, all these folks with different ideas coming together. As we homogenize education by reducing it to one score, to one test, we're missing out on that. We're right. missing out on what is needed most in the 21st century, and that's a diversity of thought. So by redefining education and narrowing it, by missing these opportunities of what the 21st century has to offer, and by narrowing the definition of what student performance is, I believe we're doing our kids a great disservice for the world they're going to enter when they leave our schools someday.
Yeah. Are we also taking the joy out of education for them when they're being taught to a test?
I think if you ask kids, and I think if you ask teachers, you'll hear a resounding yes. I think if you start to ask some other folks who might not be as involved in the day-to-day operation of the classroom and see the impact at the ground level, it might not be as resounding. But if we are boxing kids into corners and boxing teachers into corners through the way they must teach, I do believe that you do have that. And I get concerned about that. And that's why I am such an advocate for instructional approaches like the Lucy Calkins approach for reading and writing out of Teachers College Columbia, the workshop model, which really tries to tap into student motivation and engagement in reading and writing. You want to foster that because that's where you get your lifelong readers and writers, and that's where the real magic is. Now, I look at my own kids. I have three young kids, and my wife and I say all the time, our biggest area of focus is developing the love of reading and the love of writing because the skills are going to come with it with good instruction, but getting someone who loves to read, who loves to write, as a parent, one of my biggest priorities. As an educator, Absolutely. You want to develop that, foster that. Now, here's the challenge in our era. It's hard to put a number to that. It's hard to quantify that and measure it.
Right.
And one of the things you and I talked about offline before was that when you try to quantify and measure everything, sometimes you miss out on what might be the most important thing to do. You know, I said to you earlier that probably the most important thing in my life is what I can do to serve and love my wife and my kids. I can't put a number to that.
Right.
I can't tell you how much I love my wife and kids.
Right.
But it's probably the most important thing that I do in my life. And in the classroom, you probably can make some parallels there too. You know, developing a love of reading and a love of writing to get highly engaged and motivated readers and writers, if we focus too much on what can be quantified, we may lose that.
Yeah, just having kids enjoy being in the classroom and discussing with other kids relating to their teacher, whatever, it is worth much more than any test score. Now, in terms of the Common Core State Standards, let's talk a little bit about the developmental appropriateness of, at least in the lower grades. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and my thoughts are that, me personally, my jury's out. I'm not cynical. I'm cynical about the apparatus surrounding the Common Core. I'm cynical that the Common Core is almost inextricably linked to high-stakes tests and to high-stakes teacher and school and principal evaluations. That bothers me, that that apparatus is so tightly linked. The Common Core itself, if I can just take everything else apart and look at the Common Core, I'd say there's some things in there that, wow, that'd be great to get our kids to be able to do this. These are really aspirational. However, there are groups that I believe have much greater expertise on the K-3 developmental appropriateness than I do, who have come out strong and spoken out against it. So once again, there are questions. Questions should be out there. We're a thinking profession. We should have questions, and we should be going to the evidence, and we should be looking at our practice and constantly revisiting it. So my questions are they truly developmentally inappropriate at K-3? I have a group of experts who say that they are. I have teachers who are meeting with success. Some who are concerned. The jury should stay out, and we should be able to analyze this and modify it as we go forward. The concern I have with that is I don't know what that process would be, because the Common Core is so tied into our No Child Left Behind waiver, is so tied into the federal initiatives. Where do we go? Does the State Board of Ed have an opportunity to revisit the Common Core down the road like we would our standards of the last generation? I don't know. I don't know how that would look. So there are structural issues I have. Then there are substantive ones. I look at some of the standards and think, is that really a good idea for a third grader to do this or a kindergartner to do this? There are questions. So I do have questions there. But there are elements of the Common Core. I look at some of the elements around collaboration, for example, which is great. Nobody works in isolation anymore. It's clear, whether it's virtual or whether it's face-to-face.
Did we have collaboration in our own previous curriculums?
I'm sure we had it, and it may have been more, not so much by design, where the Common Core will compel us to look at it by design as we structure and build curriculum. The challenge is for us is, how do you do those elements of the Common Core when they're not on the test? Because we can say, well, we're professionals, we have to do the right thing. However, everything has forced us and pushed us to reduce our work to what's on the test. When our districts are being judged and evaluated in high-stakes accountability models, when teachers and principals are being judged and evaluated in high-stakes accountability models, we want accountability. Anybody in a profession that doesn't want accountability is not a professional. Mm-hmm. So we want accountability. But when you start to look at what's on the test being placed on a different level than the other standards, and I use the collaboration one for example, I find districts will have a hard time focusing and emphasizing those types of standards than they will the ones they know will be tested.
Right. And in talking to Jonathan Pelto and then listening to Diane Ravitch, my understanding is that the new test for the SBAC that we're using in Connecticut is designed so that only 25% of the kids will meet mastery on it and the rest will not. And so what is that going to do to teacher evaluation if a test is designed to fail the rest of them? I mean, there's something wrong with that scene to me.
I read an interesting article last week from a renowned high school principal in New York, former principal of the year, Carol Burris, who really exposed the whole concept of cut scores and the practice of setting cut scores. So once again, it left me with questions. And when I have questions, I have an instinct in me to want them answered. So pursuing that whole concept of setting cut scores and so forth, when you have a discussion around 25% of the kids meeting mastery, to me, it begs the question of assumptions. What are the assumptions? That mastery means what? That college and career means what? It begs more questions. And once you start to ask those questions, it really exposes some vulnerabilities of the new testing system. I think tests at that level are useful for districts to look from a broad perspective of how are we doing. Once you start to delve below that level, you really start to weaken the strength of that test and the usefulness of that test. So if that were the case, in states across the country so far, Kentucky and New York jump out, that the new tests have shown, say, 30%, I'm not sure what the number is, are at mastery. That raises a question to me because I have a district, for example, and I'm sure there's districts and kids all over the state that have been thriving and doing well and been well prepared for college and beyond. Are we to say that really only 25 or 30% of our kids in Connecticut are really ready because we've made up a new test that says so? Well, I think we have probably a track record of kids going to high-powered schools and taking on high-powered professions. That's probably more than 25% in our state. Oh. So it does raise questions for me, and I think that'll all unfold over the next few years. We'll see that unfold.
Yeah. My other question around the testing that I always have to scratch my head when I think about this is that I understand that the tests are, I guess it's called computer adaptive, so that if a student's doing well, they get harder questions.
Yes.
And if they're not doing so well, then the questions don't get
set.
And to me, then you're not giving the kids the same test. So how is that standardized?
There was a very interesting discussion on Education Week that was done in a blog by a gentleman by the name of Rick Hess, who is typically on the education reform, if you will, side of the equation. But he strikes me as a rather intellectually honest guy. And he raised those questions to SBAC and the other organization, PARC, that not only about the adaptive piece, but the standardization, can you really say it's standardized if you're taking them on different platforms? If you're taking them on an iPad versus a PC versus paper and pencil? If you're taking them in March versus June or whatever the window is, you know, March versus May? How do you say it's standardized if you have a 12-week, I'm not sure what the gap is, but it's about an 8 to 12-week window to take them? So there's a lot of questions about that, but there's a lot of money at stake right now. There's a lot of money at stake in those tests. $360-some-odd million was given for those consortia. And I think only 2/3 of the states right now are even going to be using those tests. So now how do you say that we're really looking, which was the initial goal, at all 50 states on the same playing field? I don't know if you can make that claim anymore if only 2/3 are using those tests and another 1/3 are using others. So I think what was envisioned four years ago may be a little different than what was actually going to be playing out.
Well, and it almost seems like if you make the test more difficult, if the kid is doing well, in a way you're setting that kid up to fail in a sense too. So the whole thing just seems really a setup.
I'm not sure how that's all going to play out. I really don't, because we've only done a test run and my district did not. We chose not to do the SBAC pilot and every district had their own choice to make. And we made a decision based on our own preferences and needs and our own judgment. So we'll do it next year for the first time. And most districts will do it for all districts will do it for real for the first time. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how that plays out.
And will parents be able to opt their children out of the test starting next year?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And it's well above my pay grade because that was asked at the legislative level. And I don't believe there's language around that, but I don't know if it's really been challenged in a way that would force a policy decision. So we'll see how that plays out too. There was a lot of momentum that seemed to be happening around the country, and we'll see if that continues at that level. Every district had their own degree of opting out requests, some more so than others. And I think that was really based on the parent voice, the parent footing. I think districts were pretty clear on how we were supposed to handle that. And most districts, I believe, did handle it the same way. But that will be interesting. That will be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Now, I know the district that I came from, they were writing the Common Core 1 week, and then the following week, they'd actually have to be teaching it. And I'm just wondering if that's, I'm assuming a lot of districts were put in that position.
Common.
Yeah. And what are you, as, you know, as an educator, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't think any educator really thinks that we need to stay 2 weeks ahead of the students. And I don't know if it was that severe. Some districts did get out in the lead and started to do this work a couple of years ago. But I don't really think that any district can say that we've been teaching the Common Core for 3 or 4 years. And that's not realistic, considering that it was 4 years ago in the summer that it was approved. Nobody did it that year, and I don't believe anyone did it the following year either, maybe a couple of outliers. But you have districts that are probably a year or two in right now and still waiting to see how this really impacts kids over time, because that's really the question, is what is this going to do over time? If you had a group of sixth graders starting Common Core now, but their K to 5 experience was different, well, that's really interesting. No one wants to sit back and wait 12 years for that first kindergarten class to go all the way through to say, was this a good decision or a bad decision? So educators have to always look at our practice, just like engineers and doctors and anybody else. Look at your practice and look at the literature and look at the evidence and say, what's the best judgment to make here? And the Common Core is a big question that needs to be answered over time.
And it seems like, though, that it's been taken out of educators' hands. So they don't even have the ability right now to say, do we like this? Is this good? Is this working? Can we keep this and throw out the rest or whatever? You know, it's been taken out of their hands.
It's a highly politicized field, and it's gotten more so. And I think to some degree, you have to look at it as the world of public servants. Police officers don't make up individual laws. You know, they carry out the laws of the ordinances of the town, the laws of the state, and so forth. And educators need to understand that we are serving the public good. So there is going to be public input, public interest at stake always. Otherwise, we go into private schools.
Right. And I understand what you're saying, except for, in my understanding, and tell me if you have a different understanding, but the Common Core was created basically by the corporate world.
Well, that's a separate conversation. Absolutely. Yeah. where the Common Core, I'm talking about, generally speaking, the Common Core itself, there is a lot of evidence to point to the lack of teachers and practitioners around the table, though there has been documentation by the CCSSO of teacher input when it came to feedback around the creation of it. However, there's a lot of, once again, a lot of questions surrounding that that I think have yet to be resolved. The reality is, as a practitioner, it's on our lap. And it is the state standard right now, and we have to respond to it. My district has chosen to take a very analytical approach to it. Here's our challenge, Cheryl, and this is clear. We have standards in English, standards in math. We've had that for decades. That's not new. So we don't lead with, here's our Common Core approach. We say, here are the standards. Now let's write curriculum around that. Our challenge is that if the standards are on the test, we really don't have the option to say, no, we're not going to do that standard. If we are going to do that, we have to have a real strong PR message to our community that our kids are not going to perform well on the test on that standard because we think that standard is better served in a different grade or not taught at all. We haven't hit that right now, but we have looked at some areas and said, is that really better in a later grade than this grade? But if it's on the test, it puts districts in a rather untenable position because you're going to set kids up for failure on the test, or you don't want to be dishonest to your community and say, we're performing at this level. Oh, but we didn't teach that standard. So there is a forced action in response.
Yeah, it sounds like a real challenge at all levels, from student to teacher to administrator. And now for those of you who may have just tuned into the show, you're listening to The Assault on Public Education on WWUH 91.3 FM. And today's guest is Thomas Scarese, the superintendent of Madison Public Schools. And now back to the program.
And one of the things we talked about is overall in public education too, and in probably in our society at large, what's happening to childhood. Yeah. That's a huge concern of mine. Yeah. And I've talked a great deal about that. I think the change in what's happened for access for students for unstructured times to socialize and for play, which kids learn a great deal around play. And I think that we have, to a degree, put kids at risk by taking those opportunities away from them. And when kids are in a system, be it a school system, that is highly structured and highly scripted and becoming more and more homogenized, and then we strip away the opportunities for more socialization and recess and play, we're doing a disservice to a generation of children.
Because they learn multiple skills in play and the social interaction. And then we're also, I think, taking the joy of learning away from them.
And that's a huge part of it. That concerns me. I read an interesting article with an executive from Google who came out unapologetically and said, I couldn't care less about test scores and GPAs. I care about how they think, Can they look at information, piece it together, and solve a problem? Can they get along with others? Can they subordinate their ego for the group? All these different facets that we learn that you can't put on a test.
Right.
So I worry about the generation that is going to be going through this era, and will they be prepared for the challenges of the 21st century? Maybe the Common Core is part of the solution, but I can tell you it is woefully insufficient to prepare kids for the world they're going to enter. There's so many challenges that are out there with globalization, with the information age, that a set of standards is not going to prepare kids for that world. Might it be part of the solution? Maybe, if done well and if done right. But I think the test-based accountability era will take away really most of what's good about what the Common Core may have to offer, because it will narrow the definition of education and continue to redefine it to one score.
And teachers will then be forced to teach to the test.
Huge concern. We've talked about that locally in my district, the narrowing of the curriculum. It feels like we're trying to fight a gravitational pull to not do that, because you're incentivized to do that. Mm-hmm. The easiest course of action is to follow what's on the test, get really, really good high test scores, and project that out to your community of, look at how good we're doing. That's the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. I think it takes a bit of a different individual, a community, and so forth to say, we really want to identify what's right for our kids. And even in the face of some of that gravitational pull, still do what's right for them.
Right. And that seems like a tricky balance to reach at this point.
It is. Communication is key. Transparency is key to keep folks in the loop about what we're learning and why and how. Because trust really is at the heart of what we do. You know, you entrust your children with other adults for 6+ hours a day. You know, it's a huge, huge amount of faith being on the table really for that. So
Yeah. And it seems to me that teachers are really stressed by these new initiatives and no longer feel like they have control over their own profession, and like they can't always do what they know is right for their students. It's quite a bind.
Yes.
And just talk about research for a moment.
Yeah.
I mean, there's enough research out there that we know what's good teaching.
Absolutely.
And it seems like no one's following that right now. It seems like that's gotten lost. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah. You know, I've said this over and over again. Our research is different from a hard science research. It's a social science. But when you track the tried and true best practices over time and you look at the literature and you couple that with practitioners' experience and intuition, you have a pretty powerful approach to how to educate kids. When you deny practitioner expertise and experience, and you deny what the wide body of evidence says, you can make a case you're committing malpractice because you're going against what the field says works. So, and a simple example, and I've said this a number of times, so it would be no surprise for folks who have heard me talk about this, none of the research out there supports using high-stakes tests for accountability in evaluation. There's some that will point to some of the evidence around using the high-stakes tests for growth purposes in evaluation, because you have a couple of purposes of evaluation. You're using it for professional growth and using it for accountability. You will not find evidence to support it for accountability purposes. Yet, we're doubling down and we're going deeper and further into that right now. So that's a question that I've raised from the beginning of, why would a profession continue down this path when our body of evidence says this is really not a good thing to do? And then even beyond just the education, you look at some of the work that's been done in some of the study and evidence in the corporate world. And we've seen really bad things happen in Enron. I wrote a little op-ed for the Washington Post recently on that. The corruption of folks in the field because of these high pressures. My concern goes further and actually under the radar. My concern is what I call the distortion of teaching and learning, because we're incentivized to teach to a test. We're incentivized to narrow a curriculum. So the actual teaching, the pedagogy, gets distorted, and suddenly you have a group of professionals that have passively accepted that for good enough. So that's a big concern of mine, that we have practitioners that know this is not good teaching, yet it's going to get good results. So now we've redefined what good teaching is because the results tell us so. So when you confuse measures and goals, bad things happen.
Yeah. And the other piece in there is, I don't know if your school has a lot of English language learners.
We really don't. And I've worked in a school as a principal of a school that had a lot.
So all this new high stakes, the Common Core, the testing seems really to defy all of the research around how long it takes to learn a language and to learn academic language. And it seems very like we're actually punishing these kids now. And I wondered if you had any thoughts.
Yeah, I think you can probably say the same for students with disabilities as well.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to narrowly identifying what it means to be proficient in a subject, in reading or in math and writing, when you start to narrow it, you have closed off and choked off a lot of those avenues for either English language learners and what's really more prevalent for me or students with disabilities to really express their understandings, their knowledge, and how they've mastered something. So that is a huge concern of mine. My district actually chose not to do the Smarter Balanced pilot because we were concerned about the experience for our students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. We weren't sure. We didn't know for sure it would be a bad experience, but we weren't sure it was going to be a positive experience. So we didn't want to put those kids in that position. And I think going forward, we're a little more confident that hopefully tweaks will be made for them next year. But time tells us that the last generation of standardized tests, the past 10, 15 years or so, those students really struggled and really suffered, especially in the test setting environments with the pressure and the feeling of a failure, mm-hmm. which is, you know, once again, what are we having our kids, what message are they leaving with? I didn't do well on that test and am I a failure because of that? That's not good for a 9, 10-year-old to be thinking that. It can become self-fulfilling.
Yes, and they'll start shutting off to education.
And they don't believe the adult. They get savvy enough when you hit 10, 12 years old to not really believe what the adult is saying, that, oh, you're okay, you're so smart in these areas. Because deep down, no, I was the last one to finish that test. And that was painful. And I did poorly on it. And my peers didn't. So what do I believe? What the adult is saying or my experience?
So as a superintendent, mm-hmm. and if you were talking to your fellow superintendents, what can be done to kind of get us back on track to combat this? You know, we're getting it from the federal government. So what can people do or other educators do? Or do you have any suggestions or thoughts on that?
You know, I would never want to prescribe for a colleague what they ought to do. What my concern is for the profession, that as educators at every level, that we need to always ask questions. We need to always, what we want our kids to do, be critical thinkers. Okay, that's number one. We need to always be critical thinkers and analytical about what's really happening. One of my biggest concerns right now is by not doing that, we passively accepted that this is what public education is and ought to be. And I can't accept that. So that's the first thing I would say, is to raise questions, explore it, have genuine inquiry. It doesn't mean you have to reject, but if you do reject, you have to have something else to replace it with. Mm-hmm. So if we're saying, for example, with the evaluation systems, that this is inappropriate for my district, well, do you have a better alternative? I would hope that we are starting to incentivize districts to be innovative, to incubate innovative practices. If we just follow along and teacher-proof classrooms, we are going to miss a generation of opportunities to innovate. So the first response I have to that is around asking questions and being critical thinkers. And the second would be to respond with innovative ideas. Mm-hmm. To not just say, that's a lousy idea, but to say, you know what? That idea might not be a good fit for my district, but here's a better alternative for my district. And I really want to put it on the table for us to really look at it and grow it. That's how a lot of industry comes up with great ideas. I'm a bit of an addict to the Harvard Business Review type of articles where they look at these case studies of how innovations occur. And they occur through that type of deep analysis and solving a problem. So I would hope educators feel the freedom to do that still. I don't think a lot of us do. I think a lot of us feel that we need to follow the script.
And in my district, it was very difficult to talk against the script. Nobody wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, so I would see that. And I have seen that and I've heard that. And every district has their own story. Mm-hmm. So I do believe in a high-performing district, and my district really has been by traditional measures a high-performing district. We have a little bit more freedom, which really isn't fair because a lot of great ideas can come out of districts that have had lower performance on traditional measures. I don't think that really is an indicator of whether the district is high quality or not. It's more of an indicator of who you're serving, quite honestly,
right.
Which, you know, the one variable that's consistent mm-hmm. with test scores is you can always find out the type of kid you're serving by looking at the test scores.
Right.
So I would never judge some great ideas that come out of what would be considered an at-risk district. But being critical thinkers, asking questions, putting it out there, don't let my ilk, a superintendent, be out of the hot seat. We should always be on the hot seat to be answering those questions and responding, and then come up with innovative practices and keep developing that. It is a challenge right now in this era because we are forced to standardize more and more, trying to take off-the-shelf lessons and units. Very disturbing for me that we would be looking for prepackaged materials to teach our kids because somebody somewhere far, far away from my district wrote that.
Right.
Certainly not with my kids in mind. And now I'm going to be, because you said that, say, in the 2 weeks ahead. Okay, you said that before, right?
Right.
Because of the pressure to implement right away, that's the easiest thing for me to do. We're going to buy this product and throw it in the classroom and have something that's aligned to the Common Core and do that. That is incredibly concerning for me because you're not considering the learner. You're not considering the context. You're not considering the repertoire of the teacher, the culture of the school, the environment, and the district, and so forth. So those silver bullets, they don't exist. We've been searching for them now for quite a bit in education, and they really don't exist.
Now, we talked earlier about the finances, people making a lot of money on this.
Sure.
And it's my belief that this is an agenda to privatize the schools. And it's not just happening in the U.S. I see it happening in countries around the world. So there's this agenda out there that seems to be worldwide. And I'm just wondering, so people are making money on computers, they're making money on the testing, they're making money on all the new, probably instructional materials to go along with the Common Core. And the Common Core was really pushed on districts by these three foundations, the Bill and Linda Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, and the Walton Foundation. So do you have any thoughts on that, on education for profit?
I do think that public education as an entity itself is at risk. It's under attack. I've said this to my teachers when we've gotten together for district-wide meetings that I do believe the profession's under assault. Where it's coming from, I can try to connect the dots and so forth, and it just seems to boggle the mind when I do that. But I do think it's clear the profession is under assault. You got probably a number of influences leading to that. There's, I would imagine, an agenda from somewhere that's doing that. But I also think that the economic times have led to that as well, where the economic costs of public education have come into question. So you have a whole other argument to dismantle public education, I would imagine. I haven't experienced it in my work to the degree that probably other districts or probably other states have. I can think of what's happening in some cities, really, Philadelphia, Detroit, and so forth. And those are emergency crisis settings right now in education. But if you look at the makeup, they're usually pretty common. You have highly, highly impoverished or high concentrations of poverty in small areas that have really led to terrible conditions in schools as well as homes. So the privatization movement, I would imagine, gets some footing in those types of areas. I don't think it has hit the outer regions of, say, the suburbs and so forth, but I do believe that it's in the crosshairs when you look at some of the initiatives that are out there and policies that are out there. So it is a concern. I think public education is strong, and hopefully we will continue to be strong over time. Because I do think it is just essential to the democracy. I just think it is and ought to be the center of a community. Interesting, I read an article recently about our two most significant drives are for survival and procreation. That was one of the statements that was made. So agree or disagree with that. But at the center of both of those are the protection of childhood and children and the development of children. So I do think it should be at the center of any community, no matter what the demographics are. And I'm a big believer in that. I've made my career around it and I'm committed to it. But I do see concerns with big philanthropy and big data informing policy. When you follow the money, if you do have the tools to do so, it can boggle the mind.
Now, it's my belief, and you can comment on this, that No Child Left Behind was initiated to privatize, and it was successful in the urban districts, as you just said, but it didn't get to the suburbs. The suburban schools were able to pass the
test.
But now, I believe the Common Core is being implemented in the new test to make it just hard enough, and now they have those adaptive testing where if the kids are doing well, they're going to make it even harder, so it's a setup where only 25% of the kids will pass these tests. And it's the test scores that lead to the state can come in and privatize. So I'm thinking that the race to the top and these new teacher evaluation testing, et cetera, have all been set up to try and get at that the suburban market. Mm-hmm. And that's what we are to these people, is a market. Mm-hmm. So I'm mm-hmm. just wondering if you have any thoughts mm-hmm. on that, because I think in the future we're going to be seeing suburban districts mm-hmm. getting charter schools and getting the state coming in and taking over. And mm-hmm. I don't think they're ready for it. I think it's going to shock people. So any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you have some interesting cases around the country. Douglas County, Colorado is one, where a pretty aggressive move to put the school choice options into some pretty affluent communities. But I think you don't look too far. Just go over the border in New York and see the reaction, the visceral reaction from parents. And it was led by suburban parents, Long Island, Westchester County, and Lower Hudson Valley. Those were the groups that were and are most vocal right now. And New York is about a year ahead of Connecticut. So you could project out and say, we followed the same path, and we could be following the same path with a bit of that level of outrage. I don't know how complacent Connecticut would be going down that path. I really can't project that. And as far as almost the approach to double down on privatization with the latest iteration of federal law, I can't speak to the intentions to it. But I think there's, when you look at policies like money follows the child, that does take away from the funding of public schools, by my understanding. Mm-hmm. So when you start to do that, I don't know if you can do a little of privatization and do it well. I think that's why more is desired from a privatizer, is to continue down that right. pathway. And this is an area that I'm certainly no expert in. I'm mm-hmm. an expert in teaching and learning and mm-hmm. in schooling and so forth, but not in this area. But there's enough smoke there to kind of link there's a fire, and what path are we actually going down yeah. with this? There's public educators are concerned all over the country. There's no question.
So we're almost out of time, Tom. Is there anything else you want to say to the listeners that we haven't talked about?
Once again, I just want to repeat the message that I try to articulate, is that I think it's so important that we continue to ask critical questions. These are the most important issues for our children right now. How we feed them, how we clothe them, how we educate them. The generation of little learners are relying on us, they're counting on us. And if we're not asking really, really good analytical questions and questioning our practice, we're doing them a disservice. There are areas that are in emergency situations right now, in crisis, in inner city environments and beyond. And I believe there's an inclination to just try to throw emergency solutions on those problems and maybe not always think them through. I just hope that we take the time to really think through what we're doing and to look at different iterations of our policies and not just stay so static. This is it. And this is what we're going to be doing for the next decade. We lived that for 12 years with NCLB, and we're living with the unintended consequences, unfortunately.
Right.
So I hope we can look back at more than a decade of a track record and say, this really isn't the right way to go about things. Not to prepare our kids for the world they're going to be entering when they leave our schools. It's a very different world, and this homogenization is not it. So I'm hoping that we just keep the conversation going.
Thomas Scarese, thank you so much for being on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
One really good website to learn more about what's happening to public education across the nation, and specifically in Connecticut, is the website jonathanpelto.com. And that's Pelto, P-E-L-T-O. So again, jonathanpelto.com. There's a June 21st article posted on the site called Madison Public School Superintendent Thomas Scarese Makes National Waves Again. And I'm going to read it to you. So here goes. Thomas Scarese, the superintendent of Madison Public Schools in Connecticut, has been identified as a public education hero by Diane Ravitch, the nation's leading public education advocate. Scarese has been a leading Connecticut voice against high-stakes, test-based school reform. A few months ago, Thomas Scarese received national attention for a letter he sent to Connecticut state legislators explaining why these reforms will not result in improved conditions since they are not grounded in research. His latest commentary piece, quote, "The Greatest Crime Committed Against the Teaching Profession," unquote, was featured on Valerie Strauss's Washington Post education blog this week. Thomas Scarese writes, "On May 25, 2006, former Enron executives Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were found guilty of fraud and conspiracy in perhaps the most high-profile scandal of corruption as a consequence of high-stakes measures. Lay and Skilling fraudulently inflated the company's stock price to meet the high-stakes demands of Wall Street's expectations. Not only did Lay and Skilling conspire to inflate stock prices, but they also distorted standard accounting practices to solely meet targets. The needs of high-stakes schemes yield corruption and distortion. The Enron case does not stand alone in the history of corruption and distortion amidst high-stakes indicators such as stock prices. As academic scholars Dr. David Berliner and Dr. Sharon Nichols demonstrate in their work, the annals of corporate history are tattered with similar cases of corruption and distortion driven by high-stakes pressures. High-stakes accountability and incentive system failures, as well as blatant fraud at Dun & Bradstreet, Quest, the Heinz Company, and Sears Auto Repair Shops illustrate that such schemes inevitably bring unintended consequences. As people, we are free to choose our actions, but we are not free to choose the intended or unintended consequences of such actions. As author Stephen Covey has written, when you pick up one end of the stick, you pick up the other end. The ubiquity of this principle is evident in the fields of medicine, athletics, higher education, and politics. Quite simply, as the stakes rise, so do the occurrences of corruption and distortion. Sadly, education is not immune to this principle. Over a decade of high-stakes accountability schemes thrust upon students, teachers, and schools have yielded sordid tales of outright corruption and cheating scandals. Although such acts of indignity garner ornate headlines and self-righteous accusations about the lack of moral character, to which there is truth, given the inescapable unintended consequences of high-stakes schemes, such corrupt behaviors and distortions of a given professional practice are inevitable and of no surprise. Yet, we march on in the high-stakes, test-based accountability era with the high probability that posterity will ask an indicting question of how a generation of educators could commit such offenses when they knew better. And again, that article was from the website jonathanpelto.com. And Jonathan Pelto is now running for governor on the Education and Democracy Party ticket. Today's show is the fifth edition of The Assault on Public Education. The show airs on the last Monday of each month from 12 to 1 p.m., and are archived for 2 weeks at the WWUH website, which is www.wwuh.org. And you can also find them on the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit for radioforall.net. Once on the site, search for The Assault on Public Education, and the show should pop up. As mentioned earlier, Diane Ravitch is one of the foremost authorities on education in the U.S., and she's written the very popular book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And I'm going to read a few excerpts from the first chapter in the book called Our Schools Are at Risk. And here goes. In the early years of the 21st century, a bipartisan consensus arose about educational policy in the United States. Right and left, Democrats and Republicans, and leading members of our political class and our media elite seemed to agree. Public education is broken. Our students are not learning enough. Public schools are bad and getting worse. We're being beaten by other nations with higher test scores. Our abysmal public schools threaten not only the performance of our economy, but our national security, our very survival as a nation. This crisis is so profound that half measures and tweaks will not suffice. Schools must be closed and large numbers of teachers fired. Anyone who doubts this is unaware of the dimensions of the crisis or has a vested interest in defending the status quo. Furthermore, according to this logic, now widely shared among policymakers and opinion shapers, blame must fall on the shoulders of teachers and principals. Where test scores are low, it is their fault. They should be held accountable for this educational catastrophe. They are responsible because they have become comfortable with the status quo of low expectations and low achievement, more interested in their pensions than in the children they teach. In response to this crisis, the reformers have a ready path for solving it. Since teachers are the problem, their job protections must be eliminated and teachers must be fired. Teachers' unions must be opposed at every turn. The hoops and hurdles that limit entry into teaching must be eliminated. Teachers must be evaluated on the basis of their students' test scores. Public schools must be evaluated on an objective basis, and when they are failing, they must be closed. Students must be given choices other than traditional public schools, such as charter schools, vouchers, and online schools. Those who advocate for charter schools, virtual schools, and, quote, school choice are reformers. Their supporters insist they are championing the rights of minorities. They say they are leaders of the civil rights movement of our day. This is a compelling narrative, one that gives us easy villains and ready-made solutions. It appeals to values Americans have traditionally cherished: choice, freedom, optimism, and a latent distrust of government. There's only one problem with this narrative. It is wrong. Public education is not broken, it is not failing or declining. The diagnosis is wrong, and the solutions of the corporate reformers are wrong. Our urban schools are in trouble because of concentrated poverty and racial segregation. But public education as such is not, quote, broken. Public education is a crisis only so far as society is, and only so far as this new narrative of crisis has destabilized it. The solutions proposed by the self-proclaimed reformers have not worked as promised. They have failed even by their own most highly valued measure, which is test scores. At the same time, the reformers' solutions have had a destructive impact on education as a whole. The transfer of public funds to private management and the creation of thousands of deregulated, unsupervised, and unaccountable schools have opened the public coffers to profiteering, fraud, and the exploitation by large and small entrepreneurs. It is not meant to reform public education, but as a deliberate effort to replace public education with a privately managed free market system of schooling. Public education is a basic public responsibility. We must not be persuaded by a false crisis narrative to privatize it. It is time for parents, educators, and other concerned citizens to join together to strengthen our public schools and preserve them for future generations. The future of our democracy depends on it. I want to thank you today for listening to this fifth edition of The Assault on Public Education. And I'm going to close the show today with the first part of a song by Van Morrison called Educating Archie. And here it is. Tell me what happened to you.